The cyber landscape is constantly evolving, creating new challenges and opportunities to defend against sophisticated attacks. At Northrop Grumman, we provide a wide range of capabilities to stay ahead of these threats. To learn more, visit northropgrumman.com/cyber.
Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report's weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Joining us today is Justin Sherman with the Atlantic Council's Cyber Statecraft Initiative, who is also a contributor to Wired Magazine, and David Levine, the Elections Integrity Fellow at the Alliance for Securing Democracy of the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Justin and David, thanks so very much for joining us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Vago, thanks for having us.
Absolute pleasure. And Justin, thanks. Thanks doubly so for joining us again, especially on such short notice today. So we've had the biggest turnout election in American history that elected Joe Biden as America's next president. But President Trump and many GOP leaders across the nation maintain there was widespread voter fraud, an allegation that's been amplified by the news sources that are that favor the president and the Republican Party, as well as other outlets, convincing tens of millions of predominantly Republican voters of widespread impropriety that is already undermining the president-elect's legitimacy. Almost every major legitimate news organization, government officials, Republican Party leaders, governors have said there has not been widespread impropriety. And in fact, Chris Krebs, the director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, has said that this election was the most secure in American history. And not only is Chris the nation's top civilian cyber official, but he's also central to the battle against disinformation. And so, you know, after giving this briefing, Chris sort of doubled down in a tweet on Friday, saying that people should ignore wild and baseless claims, even if they're made by the president. That's obviously prompted a tussle where the president wants, if news reports can be believed, Krebs fired, and that the acting Secretary of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf, has declined to execute that order. Putting all of this drama aside, David, start us off. Was this the most secure election? And if so, why was it the most secure election?
I appreciate that question. I can't sit here and say that it is the most secure election we've ever had, but I feel confident in saying that thus far, right, we still have to certify the election results, but thus far, this election has been secure by all accounts. And there's no basis for suggesting that there's been any kind of widespread fraud with regards to the 2020 election. You know, since what's happened 4 years ago, we've seen strides taken to ensure the integrity of this 2020 election. And it's been really impressive, to say the least, right? We see more voters voting on paper-based voting systems than ever before, right? Over 90% for the 2020 election. We see more jurisdictions auditing their votes following the election, which helps validate the election result totals. And we see greater cooperation happening between those on the front lines, our state and local election officials, as well as their partners, including federal agencies like CISA, the Election Assistance Commission, and the FBI. And those efforts taken together, I think, have created, right, a scenario where we were as well prepared as we've ever been to deal with potential foreign interference. And I think those things taken together have definitely contributed to an election that I think we all should feel proud about in terms of how it's been conducted thus far.
Let me ask you about voter fraud, right? I mean, this has become a cause célèbre for a lot of people, but how hard is it to tamper with our election system, right? I mean, for many people, you show an ID, you show a voter card, in other places, you just say your name and you know, you sign a roll. But you know, at the end of the day, how hard is it to cheat in this system to change votes? I think the president is alleging that something like 435,000 votes were changed in Pennsylvania. The only thing we know is, you know, actually a Trump voter tried to vote on behalf of his dead mother, so he got into trouble for that. There was a mailman, but he's since recanted his allegations as well, a postal worker, I should say. How hard is it to doctor election results?
Sure. I'm a former state and local election official, right? Before this, I was the Ada County election official, which includes Boise and its environs. And before that, I was a senior election administrator in Richmond, Virginia and Washington, D.C. And I can tell you it's extremely difficult, right, to engage in successful voter fraud. Not only do you have to be able to successfully impersonate someone else, but you have to get through all the checks and balances that exist that election administrators put in place. And that's extremely hard. And of course, for what, right? If you were to possibly engage in that behavior to change one vote, you're unlikely to change the outcome of the election, and you're likely to risk significant punishment in the form of jail time and or fines. We have seen countless studies and investigations carried out by academics, government entities, and others, and all have come to the same conclusion, right? There is no basis to demonstrate or document or show that we have widespread voter fraud. There have been localized instances of it, but it is extremely rare and extremely difficult to pull off.
Justin, let me bring you into the conversation. You and I, when you joined us last, we talked about the integrity of the system. Jay Healy, one of your colleagues also at the Atlantic Council, has also joined us. So we've discussed this whole notion of offensive cyber, right? General Paul Nakasone, the director of the National Security Agency, as well as the commander of the U.S. Cyber Command, went public by saying, our forces have gone offensive in order to defend the election. Do we know any more about how those kind of offensive cyber operations may have safeguarded our election system from foreign interference?
So we don't know too many specifics. And as you referenced, the latest podcast with Jason Healy on this issue is fantastic. And so I'd recommend to your listeners to go listen to that if they have not already. But we've heard some details, for example, about Cyber Command taking action against Iran as part of securing the 2020 election. We've heard discussion, as you referenced, of the application of this defend forward concept that the Defense Department and in particular Cyber Command adopted 2 years ago, which is essentially a more proactive posture towards adversaries and threats online, recognizing that much competition and conflict is occurring in the gray zone below the threshold of armed conflict. And so being able to persistently and continuously engage in back and forths of this kind is useful. This happened before, right? So this isn't new. In 2018 midterms, Cyber Command knocked a bot farm in St. Petersburg offline that the Internet Research Agency was using to interfere in the U.S. election. So this is a pattern that is developing as Cyber Command builds out the strategy. Again, so much of this is classified, right? We don't have specifics, but it's certainly the case that Cyber Command's activities here are one part of the broader picture that we're talking about here to secure the election that has just passed.
An important piece of this, obviously, is disinformation and then the repetition of that disinformation, which is misinformation. And so in the 2016 election, those investments that Russia made and the Internet Research Agency made, provided massive dividends. In this case, and the president of the United States has actively engaged in disinformation efforts consistently in his time in office, and one could say even as a private citizen before, and likely he will as a private citizen after he leaves office. But he has an enormous following, right? More than 71 million people voted for him. And since his statements were amplified by Republican members who still don't want to cross him in part, and the news organizations that repeat his allegations, at what point is it impossible, even for Chris Krebs or anybody else, to counter this kind of disinformation that is at base as destructive as any kinetic system? And I want to get both of your takes on this, right? I mean, at this point, is there any way to shove the toothpaste back in the tube now that you've already started these hairs running? David, why don't you start us off?
Sure. I think that's a really good question. I'm a glass half full kind of guy. And so, I do think that there's some hope, but I also recognize that, one of the problems that I think exists is that we're at a time right now where we've created it, right? There's an information space where people of one political stripe are on one platform, people of another political stripe are on another platform. And that you know, something, a point that my colleague Brett Schaefer has raised is it leads us to sort of break apart into our own information environments. And there's no doubt that you know, that's difficult for civic discourse and that's hard for democracy. I think there needs to be a real reckoning, you know, once we've gotten past this election, to sort of look at, you know, what steps can be taken to try, right, and go in the right direction here. It is a challenge. I think one thing that we can begin to do is to look to some of our, you know, transatlantic partners, in other countries, who also have dealt with, you know, disinformation efforts by authoritarian actors such as Russia and others, and have been, I think, somewhat successful in countering some of this, and possibly looking to sort of take lessons from them. But this is absolutely an ongoing challenge.
Justin?
So perhaps I'll be a bit more cynical, but I will echo what David said. He makes some fantastic points, especially, right, the fact that we have many allies and partners around the world who have dealt, in some cases, with the very particular kinds of threats we're talking about. Russia, for example, a country I study, has quite obviously engaged in not just information campaigns over time, as Thomas Ridd and others have well chronicled in various books, but they've also engaged in Twitter and online disinformation campaigns of the kind we saw in Ukraine, in Europe, right? There's lots of different other countries that have experienced these things. So I definitely echo the point about multilateralism and cooperation abroad. I'll comment a little bit, I guess, on sort of the digital side of this. So there was an excellent paper by the Berkman Klein Center at Harvard University that came out a couple months ago, where they empirically assessed mail-in voting misinformation, where this was coming from, how this was spreading, and in particular, the impact it was having. And so what they found in doing this empirical analysis is that mail-in voting misinformation was certainly spreading on social media, but they found that social media played, quote, a secondary and supportive role, unquote, in spreading misinformation. It was, in fact, traditional information venues, including the president's press briefings, including Fox News, including legitimate news outlets quoting people talking about misinformation, that was the primary vector through which it spread. And so all to say, I think we have to, kind of in line with David's comments, I definitely agree, we have to think systemically about this disinformation problem. And in the digital environment, what I mean by that is there has been much more effort, like we talked about a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, by companies, by great groups like CISA and the government, to identify and expose coordinated inauthentic behavior online. And there's various ways to do this, right? Camille Francois, who's a disinformation expert, has developed the ABC framework. You can characterize these campaigns by actor, by behavior, and by content, right? So there's ways to do this analysis. My point being, though, I think we have to really remember that these platforms, Facebook, Twitter, as David said, people use different ones, take your pick, were built for virality and engagement above everything else. And so when we're talking about a company like Facebook that comes out and says, we're going to remove disinformation from the platform, they're working against themselves in various ways, right? Because these platforms were built for engagement. Right. And so somebody, whether it's the Internet Research Agency or Donald Trump, coming in and spreading lies on these platforms, spreading hatred and vitriol on these platforms, they're not manipulating the platform to their benefit. They're using the platform exactly as it was intended. And so I realize that's a little cynical and I'm not offering any particular solution here, but all to say, I think we have to really think systemically about these platforms. And if we're thinking about comprehensive solutions, to what extent we can really address this problem with the algorithms on these sites designed as they are.
Let me just briefly, we're running out of time, and this is probably a broader strategic question. But how do you balance that? David, why don't you take this against the First Amendment, right? Because many are using the First Amendment as a shield behind which to hide, right? And certainly that's Mark Zuckerberg's point of view, right? I am not in the business of being an arbiter of truth. I'm merely a trumpet And yet folks are saying that there has to be a change to that. And how do you balance the yin and yang of this? And clearly, I'd like to have you guys back and maybe have a broader conversation on this. But just really quickly, how do you balance that against the First Amendment?
With regards to the domestic actors, it's quite difficult, right? I think, you know, one of the things I think that's important is that you're, you know, there are other ways to do it besides, right, regulating, you know, what people say on these platforms. And of course, we've seen, you know, I think more efforts in some respects by our European allies to try and sort of get at this issue. But with regards to sort of the, you know, the foreign actors piece of this, you know, I think that there needs to, I think one of the things that we'll need to do, you know, once the 2020 campaign is fully concluded, is to take sort of a wide lens and take a real look at, you know, what kinds of steps social media companies and others took to try and deal with this issue for the 2020 campaign, and compare that with the kinds of efforts that were taken, right, in earlier elections, whether it was, you know, the European Parliament election in 2019 or other elections that took place, because I do think that this is going to be sort of continue to be an ongoing challenge.
Can I jump in here for a second?
Of course you can, Justin. Go ahead.
So really quickly, I think, and perhaps this is setting the stage for that, this subsequent conversation, but I think we have to get a little bit beyond the Facebook line that they like to repeat, which is what you mentioned, that we don't want to be the arbiters of truth. And while we can understand in various respects why a company would say that, and while some of these companies are uncomfortable making these decisions, that betrays the reality, which is that these companies make decisions every day about what to keep up, what to take down, what to prioritize in their algorithms, right? So regardless of whether or not these companies say they want to be doing this, they do make these moderation decisions, which leads to my second point, which is these are not public squares legally, right? As much as they might be in effect, legally speaking, as we know, they are not subject to the First Amendment. There are things that have to be taken down, rightfully so, right? You can't have child pornography, you can't have copyright violations, right? But because of Section 230, because of what you referenced with the liability shield, they are allowed to do moderation on their platform. And so I completely agree with what David said, first of all, that we there is some real hindsight evaluation and assessment to be done of how this went. But I also think we have to remember that even if we want to get to a spot where there's a different level of accountability or regulation, we have to recognize that today these platforms very much are acting as quasi-governmental entities in the way that they have pretty much unilateral control over what is on the platform.
Guys, thanks very much. Terrific discussion. Look forward to welcoming you both back on. Thanks so much again.
Thanks for having us.
Everyone is a contributor at Northrop Grumman, and every day is an opportunity to help defend our nation and our allies. Visit our careers page at ngc.com to learn about joining the Cyber and Intelligence Mission Solutions team.